Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence brief on the war for the free world. A man whose scrupulous attention to various aspects of this war is featured prominently these days at the Washington Free Beacon and therefore informs all the rest of us concerned about what's happening in this existential struggle for freedom is our first guest. I'm very pleased to say he is Adam Credo. He is a senior writer at the Washington Free Beacon. He's been in the past an award-winning political reporter for Washington Jewish Week, and you can find his writings in a number of other places, including Politico, Jerusalem Post, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and more. Adam Credo, it's always so good to have you with us. Welcome back. It's been too long.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate having the chance to talk with you because you've been doing superb work trying to cover what's happening in the to-ing and fro-ing over the Iran deal. President Trump, of course, was hosting his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, this week, and the latter was frantically trying to get the president to extend the life of this, I call it the Obama bomb deal. Tell us, in the aftermath of the visit, where you think things stand. Will the president say in May, enough, it's defective, we're not doing more of it?
You know, it's honestly unclear to me. I can't give you an answer, affirmative or negative, but I can tell you this. If you had asked me the question maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I would have said, certainly Trump is going to pull out of the deal, but I'm leaning less towards that now following the visit of the French president, and also because of what's happening behind the scenes with the negotiating team on the U.S. side and their conversations with the Europeans. It's become increasingly clear over the weeks that they're leaning towards a package of concessions that is more appetizing to the Europeans. That means less restrictions on Iran's ballistic missile program, primarily focusing on long-range ballistic missiles, but leaving those medium-range and shorter-range ones kind of off the table. That would, in a sense, legitimize Iran's missile program, particularly when it comes to missiles that can hit Israel and other nations in the region. I think one of the other things that they're being pushed on is essentially Europe wants to continue investing with Iran. They want to do business, and what they don't want is sanctions. So it's going to be a fight for the U.S. to convince the Europeans that we need to retain the ability to sanction Iran, its central bank, things along these lines. And I think the Europeans have been winning out on this. And of course, the other piece of it that they're trying to negotiate, in addition to the missiles and the sanctions issue, they're trying to rein in the nuclear portfolio itself, that is increased inspections to Iran's contested sites. And it looks like there's not going to be much progress on this end either, because it all hinges on the Europeans getting Iran to agree, and there's no sign that they will. So from that perspective, I don't think the president is getting what he asked for, but there is a lot of pressure on him to go along with it anyway and fix it more down the road.
Oh yeah, I've heard that a lot in this town. Oh, we'll be smarter, we'll be richer, we'll be better able to get things done years from now. I don't think so, Adam. You've been around too. You said something interesting in your piece about this the other day, where you basically broke the story that the U.S. negotiating delegation, which you described as the Tillerson-McMaster team, a group that, as best I can tell, the patrons are now gone. They're not the president's people any longer, but they're nonetheless continuing these negotiations. And it doesn't surprise me, Adam, that they're cutting deals that are quite different than what the president has had in mind. I hope that in the end, the president's going to know from his current appointees, respectively, hopefully momentarily, Mike Pompeo. By the time this program airs, I'm hoping he will be confirmed as the Secretary of State. And certainly John Bolton, as his National Security Advisor, will be pointing out these deals with allowing them to have short-range missiles and keeping the pretense that this is a valuable agreement when it's seriously defective, that this will be pointed out to him, and I trust that he will respond appropriately. Your thoughts?
Look, there is a hope and sign that he will be presented the information in a different way than it was being presented by certainly Tillerson and H.R. McMaster when they were in office. It's no secret that they certainly were applying pressure from the start for Trump to remain in the deal and continue waiving these sanctions, these new sanctions on Iran that everybody has been asking for. It's very interesting to see that this negotiating team, and you're right, it stayed the same after Tillerson's exit. The White House confirmed that the team remains mostly the same, which is curious given that Tillerson was fired in large part over his failure to implement the president's will in these Iran negotiations. But I think that once they actually come back to the president with, here's what we got, here's what the Europeans will agree to, the way that'll be presented to the president by Bolton and Pompeo could actually allow him to decide, nevertheless, this isn't enough. This is not what I asked for, and I want to leave the deal. But I still think it's a question of whether he gives in to that really monumental pressure from not just within the administration, but certainly outside and with European allies to stay in this thing for a bit longer.
Yeah. Hey, Adam, very quickly, tell me about the evidence that the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the Mahmoud Abbas regime in the Palestinian authorities, Fatah, whatever you want to call them, are in fact using American dollars, taxpayers' dollars, to pay for terrorists or their families or both, despite this new Taylor Force law that is designed to penalize them for doing just that.
Yeah, there's no indication they've stopped these payments, these pay-to-slay payments. They've been using USAID, at least a portion of it, for years to supplement the salaries of terrorists who are in prison and taking care of their families as well. The Taylor Force Act, as you mentioned, was supposed to crack down on this. There's no sign really that it has. And the State Department this week is actually required to report to Congress on it and what they're going to do. I think the report is not going to be looked at favorably by those in Congress, and they're going to be looking for a full cutoff in USAID to the Palestinian Authority because of their refusal to end this program. They've been very vocal about it.
Yeah. Well, again, another of the things that I think will mark the distinction between the previous insubordinate subordinates, I've called them, President Trump had running his foreign policy establishment, and the new ones who I think are going to be telling him the truth and speaking truth to the American people will be, that report will be hopefully accurate about what the PLO is up to, and that it will in fact mean that we stop subsidizing the terrorist activities of that outfit. It's Sharia supremacism, and it's not something we should be enabling. Adam Credo, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. Your writings at the Washington Free Beacon are really appreciated, Adam. It's something you probably don't hear often enough about, but we're always delighted to be able to showcase it here at Secure Freedom Radio, and I hope that you'll come back to us often in the days ahead. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Congressman Duncan Hunter joins us next. We'll talk about the scandal of having Saddam Hussein's bomb maker running American ports. How do you like them apples? Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined by Duncan Hunter, the younger, I guess is how we should call him. His father, Duncan Hunter Sr., was a great friend and, in fact, a keeper of the flame of the Center for Security Policy back when he was chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. His son represents these days the 50th Congressional District in the House of Representatives and is also on the Committee on Armed Services, as well as the subcommittee chairman of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee's Subcommittee on Maritime and Coast Guard Transportation. Congressman Hunter, thank you so much for joining us. It's really good to have you back, and I want to salute you for some of the things you've been up to and hear more about them. So, welcome.
Hey, Frank. Great to be with you. Thank you.
So let me ask you, Congressman, you have played an incredibly important role of late on some things like the Qualcomm takeover that a company called Broadcom had in mind. You staved off what I think was really an impending disaster there. Tell us a little bit about the backstory, if you would.
Yeah, pretty simply, Qualcomm's a company in San Diego that makes the 5G, LTE, next-gen chips, the chips we have in our iPhones now or our Android phones. Those are Qualcomm chips, and they go into just about every commercial system that has to have some kind of cellular network tie-in, and they also go into all of our defense systems because our guys in the battlefield in Iraq, Afghanistan, Africa, anywhere in the Middle East, they all have these networks that we create now within our own units, and we use the same chips. They're hardened, they're more encrypted, but they're still the same chips that I have my iPhone. We use in a battlefield iPhone overseas. So that's what Qualcomm does. That's to our country, the value of that and making chips and chipsets that do this. This is the equivalent to being able to make steel in World War II to win the war, to be able to give Britain and all of our allies all this gear and equipment that basically won the war in the end, being able to outmake the Germans. That's what Qualcomm does for the U.S. That's the strategic asset that they are. They're not in my district. They are in San Diego. They have over 10,000 employees and a lot of ancillary jobs associated with them in San Diego. But Broadcom, which is a massively Chinese affiliated company, I think it was out of Singapore, tried to take them over. And you would have had then China owning basically every chip into everything in the world, including from our iPhones here to the guys on the battlefield in Africa. They would have Chinese chips in them.
Well, that would be a problem, wouldn't it? From a national security point of view, to say nothing of commercial, that's a problem. And yet it very closely, nearly happened. I understand that you were able to talk to President Trump about this and might have had something to do with the very commendable intervention that he made. Can you share anything on that?
Yeah, I was able to thank him as well. He was in San Diego, and I thanked him for saving Qualcomm and not only saving those jobs, but keeping national security one of his primary focuses. And he said, "You're welcome." He said, "We're not going to let the Chinese get that technology." But I was in San Diego. So, yeah, it was great of him. That was a good lick.
You have also been engaged for some time now in another transaction that like the Broadcom hostile takeover of Qualcomm, seems to me to be manifestly contrary to the national security interests of the United States. It involves a company out of the Persian Gulf called Gulftainer. What can you tell us about this outfit and the control that it's now exercising over, one of our strategic ports, and impending apparently is another one?
Yeah, Gulftainer, it's a Middle Eastern company. They have family connections to a Dr. Jafar Shia Jafar, who is a top nuclear Iraqi scientist. The company's founder is his brother. Okay, so that's the first tie-in. When the Iraqi nuclear scientist, when his brother owns a company, you might want to keep your eyes open for that. So this is one of those interesting things where, as a conservative, I like free markets, and just like the Qualcomm deal, I think the company should be able to purchase other companies or do whatever they need to do, unless national security interest is threatened, and that's what you have here. I don't know if people know this, but we have a thing called the Jones Act, meaning any coastwise trade or river trade in America, in the whole country, whether it's on a river or it goes from Norfolk, Virginia to San Diego, California, if it hits U.S. points, it's got to be a U.S. ship with a U.S. crew. So you have a U.S.-built ship with a U.S.-trained crew, so they're all U.S. mariners. That means that the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol don't need to patrol all the different boats on the rivers carrying petroleum, carrying chemicals, carrying coal, carrying radioactive, just carrying all these different things, medical materials. That's what's on our inland waterways every day. Okay, so we make sure we have U.S. crewed, U.S. built ships. So here you have Gulftainer now coming to Delaware saying, we want to have a port here, which means they're going to be responsible, with DHS overseeing them, for checking all the cargo that people bring in, checking the people that are allowed on the port. And I'll tell you what, Frank, here's the most worrisome thing here. If you want to get a weapon of mass destruction into the U.S., you're not going to walk it across the border with Mexico on your back in a giant backpack. you're not going to land with it in LAX and say, here's my weapon of mass destruction. You're going to use a cargo container. That's how the bad guys will get a weapon of mass destruction into the U.S. next is through some kind of a shipping container. One of the easiest ways to make sure that to have that happen is by this container deal going through and things like this.
But the trouble is, and you were on this back when it happened, I think it was 2014, if I'm not mistaken, Gulftainer got its hands on one of our strategic ports down Port Canaveral in Florida. And you tried to get a CFIUS review, as I understand it, at that time, this Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, and nothing happened. Can you shed any light on what that was about, especially since this company, Gulftainer, as I understand it, you're so right about the shipping containers, but it also seems to have another problem, which is that it's got a joint venture with a Russian company that puts cruise missile launchers concealed in shipping containers. I mean, what could possibly go wrong with a company like this? What's the story on the port they already have?
Well, here's the big difference. Nothing's happened down in Florida yet at that port, but, you know, just here's the big difference. You had Obama then, you have Trump now. You had a president that wasn't only sympathetic towards the Middle East and in that area, and I think companies that were Middle Eastern companies, and to the Muslim religion, that was President Obama. I think President Trump is more pragmatic and practical and realizes that if there's a national security threat, that it's okay for the president or the Department of Defense or the Secretary of Defense to step up and stop a deal. With what happened in Florida, that was under Obama. I think we can get a different take this time. But Frank, you have the Chinese buying ports. And let's take this one step further, too. What CFIUS doesn't look at is, say that you and I are two smart guys who drop out of MIT and we decide to do the next big thing and we're able to do a transporter like in Star Trek, right? So you and I are in our garage and we built a transporter and it's going to be revolutionary technology, but we need to raise money. We need to raise like $50 million. The Chinese come into our two-person company, think Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, and says, hey, guys, this is awesome. We'll give you $100 million. You keep working for us. We'll make you rich forever, and it's our technology. You and I are going to say yes, Frank. That's what's happening right now, too. And that's so below the radar, it's almost impossible to track it because you have all these incubator companies with brand new, awesome technology, and the Chinese are finding them prior to them even going into becoming a corporation when they're still just a small business. So I don't know how we get our arms wrapped around this, but we have to.
Well, it seems to me, let's start at the beginning. We've got a company that's already problematic, that's got control of one port and is in the process. It's very close. It's been approved now by both the Port of Wilmington and the General Assembly of Delaware. I know you've written the president urging a CFIUS review of this Gulftainer transaction in Delaware. I think you're right. He would be horrified if he knew that we had Saddam's bomb maker and, you know, a Russian Club K container company importing shipping containers into the United States, controlling one, two, maybe more. I gather these guys have got their eyes on other ones. Congressman Duncan Hunter, what is your sense of whether the president will in fact engage on this? And if so, shut down at least these port transactions? I'm reminded of your father's very, very pivotal role, well, whatever it was, 15 years or so ago, I think, when he stopped, effectively, the Dubai Ports World takeover of six or more of our ports. Is there a chance that we'll have that happen here, do you think?
I don't know, because you have two things that have to happen first. The governor of Delaware has to approve the deal, and he has not done so yet. And CFIUS looks at this automatically. So CFIUS will review this, and the governor has to okay it. I think during the CFIUS review, we're going to talk to Secretary Mattis some more and make sure it's in his vision here, that he understands what this is and what's happening. But you still have two things that have to occur, the governor and the CFIUS review. But we also wrote the president, and if he needs to get involved, hopefully he'll do so, and we'll keep urging him to do the right thing on it.
Good. Well, we appreciate tremendously your staying on it and the fact that you're bringing your leadership. You understand the Coast Guard. You're a Marine. You understand the national security. Your role in this is incalculably important, as is if I could just pivot to one other piece that you were talking about. I know your colleague, Congressman Rob Pittenger, is now trying to work on legislation, I believe with Senator John Cornyn, on reforming the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Are you having inputs into that process? And if so, can you try to make sure that we're going to up the role of the national security team in this? It's run, as you know, by the Treasury Department, which never saw a foreign investment it didn't like, as far as I can tell.
And I'm on the Armed Services Committee, so we come at this from the same way that Robert Pittenger, but from a defense aspect. And from the bottom up, I said earlier, there's billions of dollars worth of technology transfer happening right now in Steve Jobs, Bill Gates kind of technology environments where these guys are creating companies and the Chinese are just taking them. And the Chinese are stealing everything anyway. So we're looking at it from that aspect, saying, hey, how do we recognize when there's technology that'll be valuable to us and our national security that we don't want other countries to have? How do we recognize that early? Because that's a hard part too, Frank. I mean, what do you go out there and say, hey, anybody that's doing any semiconductor chip making, we're now going to make you a national priority and you're not allowed to sell anymore or take any other of your parts from overseas, from Taiwan or China. It gets very complicated, but you got to delve deep into the supply chain in the Defense Department. And that's kind of the aspect that we do. And that we have a hearing on that today, actually, CFIUS and DOD.
Thank you so much for taking some time with us, Congressman Duncan Hunter of California. I am, again, grateful to you for your leadership, both in the maritime space as well as in the armed services more generally. Come back to us soon. We really appreciate your being on top of it and keeping us on top of it as well. Next up, Matthew Vadim joins us to talk about the dangerous and discredited Southern Poverty Law Center. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of my favorite analysts and troublemakers in the battle space of the War of Ideas. He is Matthew Vadim. These days, he is a senior vice president at the Capital Research Center, which is self-described as America's investigative think tank, and they do a splendid job, in part thanks to Matt's great work. He is a frequent contributor to publications like Front Page Magazine, American Thinker, PJ Media, The Daily Caller, and The American Spectator. He's also an adjunct scholar at the James Madison Institute. And perhaps most importantly, at least by my lights, he is the author of a terrific book published by the Center for Security Policy Press. It's called Team Jihad: How Sharia Supremacists Collaborate with Leftists to Destroy the United States. It's available for free at securefreedom.org, and we're always delighted to catch up with. Listen, some of the trouble that's being made by people other than you, though you are making book on what they're doing, which is extremely helpful, is coming from an outfit you're familiar with called the Southern Poverty Law Center. Doesn't seem to have much to do with poverty, as best I can tell. Give us the latest on this outfit, who they are, and how much they're worth at the moment, Matt.
Well, I discovered recently, Frank, that the Southern Poverty Law Center, in its last filing with the IRS in the fall, disclosed that it had net assets of close to $500 million. That is $447 million, which is virtually unheard of in the world of political advocacy nonprofits. It's a staggering amount, and you have to wonder, well, is there that much Southern poverty around that they need that kind of money? And I think the answer is a pretty resounding no. They have apparently been raising oodles of money based on their exaggerated accounts of President Trump and his administration, and they're characterizing him as a white supremacist, racist, fascist dictator or would-be dictator. In other words, they've been ginning up all sorts of unfounded fear in order to fill their coffers, and they get the money generally from guilt-ridden liberals, particularly white liberals, who are suckered in by their compelling direct mail letters.
Well, that's a lot of direct mail for sure. Do we have any indication that big players like, say, George Soros or maybe Middle Eastern potentates who find it expedient to have an organization like the Southern Poverty Law Center, or as it's called, the SPLC, doing their heavy lifting when it comes to things like defaming people. And by the way, full disclosure, I'm among those that they're defaming. The Center for Security Policy is. I suspect you have been as well. It's not just Donald Trump. They've been going after all manner of people.
You are one of their favorite targets, you and your organization.
Yeah. I'd like to think, Matt, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me that there's a correlation between organizations that are effective and their efforts to silence them.
Well, as they say, if you're taking flak, you must be over the target, right?
We are living over the target, that's for sure.
That's right. I don't think Soros has been involved in funding the Southern Poverty Law Center, at least not to any sort of significant extent. They don't really need his money.
Yeah, at this point. But hey, Matt, but the question recurs. There is almost certainly, especially when a very substantial amount of this money, as best I can tell, is housed in offshore accounts. A possibility that some of it, at least, is coming from people that they don't want to disclose. Not the little old ladies or white people who are sending in, you know, direct mail contributions. What do we know about that?
Yeah. Well, we don't really have proof that the mad mullahs of Iran are sending money or that anybody from Saudi Arabia is sending money. But they do have suspiciously large bank accounts in Bermuda and the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands, as was previously discovered. And they do sock away tens of millions of dollars there. And apparently, Richard Cohen, the president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, was asked about this. And he said, oh, it's nothing out of the ordinary for any large corporation. There are tax advantages to putting some money overseas. So he made it out like it was no big deal, that it was just part of normal corporate tax planning, which I find hard to believe since the Southern Poverty Law Center is already exempt from taxes.
Yeah. And Matt Vadim, let me ask you, you've written, I think, very thoughtfully and quite informatively about how Sharia supremacists collaborate with leftists to destroy the United States. This is the subtitle of your book, Team Jihad. One of the ways that this red-green axis, as we've come to call it, seems to be operating at the moment is in the service of the IT giants, the Facebooks, the Googles, the Twitters, the YouTubes, I even would say Wikipedia, that are increasingly, manifestly instruments of political warfare being used by the left against people like us. But what role is the Southern Poverty Law Center playing in their efforts to censor or otherwise suppress conservatives?
Well, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Twitter adopted guidelines that seem to have been inspired by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, is a rabid leftist, and he raised a lot of eyebrows recently when he favorably commented on an article that said essentially that we need to have a civil war in America and wipe out conservatives.
That should raise eyebrows.
Yeah, for good reason. And, you know, Twitter is dishonest, as most of these big social media giants are. They engage in shadow banning, which is not telling the subject that he or she or it is being suppressed in the search results and not being fully exposed to the public.
And you only find out that you're shadow banned when you see, you know, your followers or the pickup of your pieces dropping off rather dramatically. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, dramatically, or you never get up there. Like I suspect I'm shadow banned because I've been on Twitter for like 10 years, regularly contributing to it, and I still have only like 3,000 and something followers. But hey, maybe I'm a lousy marketer. Who knows?
Well, but you're an excellent analyst and raconteur of what the problem is, and I suspect it's not an accident, comrade, as the Soviets used to say, that you're not getting the kind of following that you deserve, Matt. One of the things that I think we can increasingly prove is that there is a more and more aggressive effort being made. You mentioned civil war a moment ago, by a radical leftist group called Antifa. You've done a piece recently about this organization, if I can call it that. Tell us about the origins of Antifa, Matt Vadim.
Well, Antifa is a short form for anti-fascist action, and it's been around in one form or another since Hitler's SA, stormtroopers, roamed the streets of Weimar Germany. And, you know, it's waxed and waned with the times. And, these are basically, street fighters who would go in and brawl with the people whose politics they didn't like and shut down their meetings and intimidate them and did the same things that the Nazis did. So there's kind of counter Nazis embracing the same, claiming not to be Nazis and to hate the Nazis and the fascists, but yet embracing their tactics, almost to a T. And that's what Antifa is. It's a decentralized, I wouldn't say it's a group, it's a movement. It's like a loose agglomeration of hardcore leftist groups, mostly anarchists and communists and other, militant socialists. They like to don black masks and black outfits. They call that the black bloc style. And they cause riots. They stopped Milo Yiannopoulos from speaking at UC Berkeley last year and did a reported $500,000 to the campus and to its environs in Berkeley, California. And they use, whatever violence, whatever means they have available to them to attack people they perceive as fascists. The main problem with that is that the word fascist is really loosely defined. And would include you and me and tens of millions of conservative Republicans across America. So anybody they don't like is a fascist, and they like to beat them up with sticks and Molotov cocktails, and that's their thing.
Well, and unfortunately, it's increasingly our thing in the sense that it is being wielded as, at the very minimum, a threat to enforce the silencing of those they disagree with, and at worst, to actually wreak havoc, as you say, to cause violence and damage and worse.
That's right. And the Islam angle here, the Muslim angle, is that anybody who's in any way skeptical of Islam is treated as, is called an Islamophobe, like made out to be a terrible bigot. And so you're not even allowed, this is where the thought police function comes in, I would argue, that you're not even allowed to have an honest discussion about Islam because it keeps getting shut down by these people and their allies and their left-wing allies in the media and academia who don't want an honest, frank discussion about Islam and its role in the world.
Well, specifically, I think what the Muslim Brotherhood is doing in the way of this sort of stealthy form of jihad, they can't afford to have that exposed. So, as you say, Matt Vadim, in your book, Team Jihad, and just now, we're watching an unholy alliance, and I mean that in the literal sense of the word, an unholy alliance between those on the hard left, like these Antifa characters, as well as the jihadis, and Sharia supremacists more generally. Matt, your recounting of all of this is incredibly important to the cause of freedom and to helping the rest of us understand what we're up against. And Matt, we'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we will speak with David Goldman about how do we compete with China. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being, just about every week, by David Goldman, a.k.a. Spengler, in the Asian Times, where he is a managing partner as well as a columnist. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die. And I had just a moment ago a very interesting conversation with Congressman Duncan Hunter, who is worried about what's happening specifically in the context of Broadcom's efforts to take over a major American company, Qualcomm, which, as you know, the president intervened to prevent. But more broadly, what China is doing to scarf up essentially tech companies that are doing cutting-edge work, some of them even before they become companies. I'd be very interested in your thoughts about how do we try to preserve the seed corn of our intellectual property and not least our national security edge?
Well, preserving seed corn is tough over the long term. You have to develop hybrids that wipe out the other guy's crop. President Trump was magnificently right to spike the attempt by Broadcom out of Singapore to take over Qualcomm and to protect American intellectual property generally. Longer term, the Chinese strategy is much more insidious. Take telecommunications equipment, where they dominate the market. Huawei is now by far the largest participant. They spent 10 years undercutting prices, bankrupting their competition, forcing companies like Cisco out of the hardware business. And then, particularly in Europe, they just hired all their engineers. So they now have a massive R&D program. They didn't buy Ericsson. They didn't buy Alcatel. They reduced their operations, and they hired the unemployed engineers. So most of their research now is done out of Italy and Ireland. Astonishing. They're going to do the same thing with chips. There appeared today in Nikkei Asia a survey of the Chinese chip manufacturing industry, and they quoted a Chinese chip executive saying, "We're now importing $260 billion of chips a year. It's the biggest import. We're going to produce them at home. We're going to subsidize it. We don't care if we lose money. We don't care if we create a glut on the market. We are determined to be number one." So the Chinese will do the same thing at chips they did in telecom equipment. They'll glut the market. They'll crush prices. They'll destroy profitability for the American and European producers, and they'll pick up the remains.
You know, this was described the other day in a piece that I saw as industrial warfare, which is a term that I hadn't heard before, but it seems apt. When you're dealing with a country that has essentially limitless resources to engage in this kind of industrial warfare, David Goldman, does it not require of us, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but I just keep coming back to it, does it not require of us, at the very least, a recognition that you're in that kind of war, obviously, but also that you may need some sort of industrial program, agenda, policy, if you will, that is designed to counteract it? Or are we simply doomed to being dependent upon China for, you know, the material we need to defend ourselves against them, which seems, shall we say, a bad plan?
We are not doomed. There's always a good point and bad point about putting hundreds of billions of dollars into industrial policy. The Chinese are doing it. But when you do that, you make vast commitments of your resources to existing technologies. If we develop better technologies, we turn the whole Chinese investment into junk, the equivalent of an 8-track tape player. And we're capable of doing that. For example, people right now, a chip fabrication plant costs $5 or $10 billion. It's a gigantic investment. There's technology on the drawing board. It's theoretically possible to print the chips, the lithography at the micro molecular level at a fraction of the cost. There are people working at it at MIT and other places. We should be funding the cutting edge innovation and teaming up with corporations the way DARPA used to do with military technologies. I don't think we should be subsidizing existing technologies. We should be giving a huge amount of impetus to frontier technologies that will leapfrog the Chinese.
Certainly, it's served us well in the past, as you say, David Goldman. But I guess the question is, if the Chinese seem to be more agile in seeding or seizing, if you will, those kinds of companies, do we have that option any longer? Unless somebody's going to say, wait a minute, you're doing cutting-edge work of the kind we know is going to be transformative, both for our commercial sector as well as for our national security. Don't even think about selling this stuff to the Chinese. I mean, is that not something we have to be doing? And obviously trying to help protect them from being simply ripped off by Chinese cyber attacks.
Well, if we attempt to stop the Chinese from buying our existing technology, almost certainly they will find a way to reproduce it. Huawei, for example, is almost at the point of competing with Qualcomm on the chips that are used in smartphones. playing defense with existing technology is a good thing to do, but defense by itself doesn't win wars, and this is indeed a war. I'm more concerned about the fact that President Trump doesn't yet have a science advisor. There's nobody running the White House Office of Science and Technology. The Defense Department has a very good light infantry commander as SecDef. I have a lot of respect for General Mattis, but he does not appear to be the kind of, say, visionary about high-tech warfare that, for example, Harold Brown or Caspar Weinberger were.
I wonder whether we're talking past one another, because I very much take your point that big investments in current technologies can rapidly be outflanked or overtaken by the progress of technology. I'm trying to get at this problem that Congressman Hunter was talking about. You didn't have the opportunity to hear it, but basically he was saying, look, when you've got the Bill Gates sitting in his garage, even before he's incorporated Microsoft, you find that the Chinese are sometimes going in and saying, look, I'll give you $100 million right now for the stuff you're coming up with, the breakthrough technologies that are not the current model, but hopefully a step or two or three down the road. I say hopefully if we own it, not so much if the Chinese do. But do you have any thoughts on how to get your arms around that piece of this thing, other than just have a DARPA-like, agile, you know, government grant-making operation that hopefully is better than the Chinese?
Right now, if you have a hardware idea, anything to do with physics in electronics, telecommunications, and so forth, you're likely to take it to Asia, to Taiwan, to Korea, or China, because that's where the aggressive funding is for that kind of project. We're simply not doing it in the United States. You need the whole pipeline between federally supported R&D, corporate laboratories, venture capitalists, and the IPO market, a way for people to bet on new technologies and, you know, possibly get very rich. That's what we're not doing. And we have to hit on all cylinders. Otherwise, the talent is going to move to Asia. It already is. I helped take some Chinese tech companies public in China as an investment banker. These are old guys educated in the U.S. I asked them, why didn't you stay in the U.S.? They said, we couldn't get any funding in the U.S. Sometimes we couldn't get a visa. So we're making no effort to counter the Chinese recruitment of talent. The thing that worries me is a company like Huawei, which used to just rip off everybody's technology, now has a bigger R&D budget than Microsoft.
Right. Let me just close by saying this. I guess that's kind of what I'm thinking about as an industrial policy. It's not to have the U.S. government dictating everything and running everything, heavens knows. But there does seem to be something missing from this equation. And a piece of it, at least, is those hedge fund managers or those folks who are in the business of pursuing in other ways the funding of research and development of advanced cutting edge technologies seem less and less to be, well, I call it equipped with national security mindedness. And I wonder if that's a piece of this that requires more government involvement than might otherwise be the case.
I hear from a lot of venture capital types that they don't like going through the Pentagon. They don't like the military being the focus of R&D because isn't war a terrible thing? It isn't the threat of nuclear war unimaginable. That wasn't the case under Reagan. It's always the case that the military, in the pursuit of war-winning technologies, is going to put R&D at the frontier of physics and drive the really critical breakthroughs.
David Goldman, thank you so much for your time today, the work you do at Asia Times. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.